Mic check. 1, 2, 1, 2. Guys, hello. Will, unfortunately, has been kind of paused by his cat today. That's right. Will made out with his cat, Marty.
I warned him.
And it's what white people do. He's still here. He's just out of commission. But we're going to go ahead as promised. We have Alex Perrine here.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about a McGruff the crime dog can get it.
I'm still here. I'm still alive. Just, you know, a little bit low energy, but we might as well start off the episode. Felix has already introduced our guest for the week. It's returning champion, Alex Perrine of Splinter. Hello.
Hello.
What's going on?
RIP to Hawaii. Prayers up to Hawaii.
Yeah, to the fan of ours who did this as an epic prank. Not funny.
It was in their defense, they were trying to do one of those positive social experiments where it would be an Amber Alert. It would be like, alert, you're beautiful, smile, you're worth it. And they were like, oh no, I didn't take off the nuke template. Oh fuck, now everyone's mad at me.
Once again, shout out to our fan, Tommy Lee Jones from the film Under Siege.
And the best part of this is that you get to pick over what this is false flag to cover for. Mm. Pizzagate? Russia? An impending crack on North Korea? Any flavor of paranoia can be sated by this action, so congratulations.
Well, Donald Trump's plan to introduce loot crates to the U.S. military could not have come soon enough.
Yeah, Hawaii's still here. We're still here. I'm still here, most importantly of all, after a nasty stomach virus. But to start off this week, up until, you know, it's hard to plan these shows in hyper normalized world, because I thought this week was going to be shithole week. Mm. And I guess that was, you know, the Pee Wee Herman word of the week.
Yeah.
And when you hear shithole, everyone just go, ah! Everyone scream.
Well, everybody on CNN who like acted like kids in school when the teacher goes out of the room, just going insane, like, we could swear now? This fucking rips.
I loved, yeah, they all didn't know how to swear. They're Mr. Trump passed the damn executive orders. I don't want any damn immigration quotas. Rod, where did you learn that? Don Lemon, where did you hear that?
I mean, yeah, I guess if the president curses, then that gives, you know, our institutions, like the gray lady, the New York Times, which is usually very persnickety, now they have an excuse to say, North Korea's a bitch-ass motherfucker.
No, we're already in my favorite part of the news cycle, when it's people who are like, guess what? My great-great-grandparents came here from Ireland in 1902.
Well, I am a shithole American, sir.
It's like,
I am a proud resident of a shithole.
There are two equally stupid responses, and one of them is like, attention, sir, did you know that your grandparents came from a shithole? And then the other one is, actually, a scientist once came from Haiti.
those are the best ones, where it's like, I like the ones where it shows like troops and it's like, yeah, guess what? This guy died in one of our dumb wars.
Yes.
He was like, from a shithole.
I do like that now the people on Twitter whose names are like Deplorable Merle now have an exact mirror image in like Shithole Maria. Steve Shithole.
This one's interesting, because I remember right after the election, like one of the big lines with liberals was being mad at the media, because they were like, you were too unfair to Hillary, and you also covered every like Trump minutia. You covered every micro controversy and allowed him to turn it into a culture war, which galvanized his base, but people got fatigued of it, and it gave him free airtime, I guess, was their argument. Like, he wasn't running for president. But there is an argument to be had that like, covering every single thing he says is like a bad way to cover him, that you should mostly cover his policies because they're wildly unpopular. But then also, once he got inaugurated, they're like, resisting is to subscribe to the two biggest newspapers.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you know it, the A1 stories all the time are those Washington Post and New York Times articles that are like, look what stupid thing this asshole said. And it's like, yeah, they're stupid and fucked up all the time, but it's like,
but also like Nixon said the N-word. Like, what precedent have they just like completely adjusted their minds to Obama era, and they just can't move on from that?
Well, that's the thing, is like, Obama, when he was in there, like, This is
also said the N-word.
He's all the time. Time. Constantly. He had Marc Maron.
They had to tell him to stop.
Marc Maron was with him. They were doing like an 8-year long WTF.
I have heard from credible sources that he did during one budget negotiation call Mitch McConnell a honky.
That's the honky tape. But it's like if okay, so what is this job of chief executive? He's the chief commander in chief of the armed forces. He can make life and death choices with the stroke of a pen. Most of the time he fucking picks death because that's what you do as the head of an empire. And you end up, even if you're a smart law professor and thoughtful guy like Obama, you say things like, no, I'm good at killing people. And if you're a fucking idiot like Trump, you go, I don't want people from the shithole countries. But it's largely the same policy. Like if you remember, Obama resumed deportations of Haitians in September of 2016, like before the election. So there are two things going on with this. You have the liberals gaslighting themselves by saying we shouldn't cover Trump this way, but then only reading coverage of him this way and only talking about the dumbest things that the dumbest man alive says and buying into these like 24-hour news cycles that ultimately mean nothing for him. And also excusing and making it so he's the first bad president.
Yeah.
And ignoring the imperial powers of the presidency.
That's the that's the worst tendency of the sort of cable news press and some of the dumber people in the print press is, like, he's the first bad president. You see it with the shithole thing, which, again, it could have come out of a Nixon tape. It could have come out of a Johnson tape.
Yes.
When turning it into a discussion about vulgarity actually does distract from the sort of, I mean, so if you want to talk about, here's everyone covers these Trump outbursts like they're sort of individual distinct things, and I think the criticism is, well, you're not tying it into a narrative of who he is and who the country is, and like, so yeah, that you can easily fit that into a coherent and more damning narrative about his worldview and how it succeeded in 2016, but instead you get the half giggling, I can't believe he used that word.
He called the poop shit.
Yeah. I think Matt is right about also like the libidinal delight that a lot of these people are experiencing for the first time because they've been so repressed, and now Paul Krugman is walking around with a badass motherfucker wallet.
It's like Trump's president. You can swear now. Just go for it.
Yeah, like it's righteous. Matter. He's ruining the world by swearing, and we're saving it by swearing. And it's like actually,
hell yeah, fuck nugget.
There's a whole political life going on outside of this sound and fury, you know, culture war bullshit.
Well, I mean, what could it do to your brain to hang on the every word of the dumbest man on earth? I mean, if that's your life. Who would imagine that would be good for your mental acuity, for your sanity, to do that? Like, try that in your own life. Find the stupidest person you know and invest your entire emotional well-being in every word that comes out of their mouth and see how well.
I have a baby, so.
Well, stupid baby.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
Trump's calling out his stupid baby.
My baby
Trump
is an idiot.
Is America's terrible baby.
Yeah. He is a terrible baby. That's true.
Well, it's like you become him. What is the resistance last big thing before this? It was screaming at Vanity Fair. I think you got that from somebody.
It is actually, you know, now that I sort of think about it, like I find myself in parenthood, like you find like speaking to inanimate objects like they're babies now because my mind is in there.
Yeah,
I'm like oh,
now I worked at a daycare
toaster,
in an infant room, and I felt myself losing vocabulary.
Yes.
But where I want to go with this is along this line of, like, we began 2018 with our sort of thesis statement for the year, or like of where we're going in 2018, is that the hashtag resistance has become the hashtag teacot of a few years ago. I'm sorry if you're bored of this already, but I suspect it will be a theme we'll be returning to. And by that, that's just like a way of saying that like Trump has shifted the Overton window so far to the right that like what is traditionally thought, like the Democrats are just moving right along there with them. And I want to touch on something, Alex, that you wrote this week for Splinter about the actual meeting that these shithole comments came out of, right? So this was a meeting, and then Dick Durbin came out of the meeting, and he was like, I've never heard language that awful said by our president. And, you know, then you have Paul Ryan saying, like, it was very unhelpful, very unprofessional. But, Alex, could you talk a little bit about, like, What were the actual contours of what was being negotiated in this immigration deal that the Democrats were there to talk to Trump about?
So the reason that Trump even had was even debating shithole countries is that a group of lawmakers was sitting there talking about the deal they were trying to cut to save DACA and you know get the Dreamers like help them stay in the country. But the deal that was being negotiated was that basically Congress was going to restrict legal immigration. So they were going to I think that the deal as constituted was going to basically give up the diversity visa lottery or at least severely restrict it. And then they were talking about the countries with temporary protected status who, like the Salvadorians who just got that removed, there are people who, because we fucked up their countries, were like, we won't deport you back there because we fucked up your country pretty
bad. And that was the El Salvador thing?
Yeah.
And now that's been rescinded and there's about 200,000 Salvadorans in America who are now of dubious legal status?
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, what was being negotiated was, which countries will we restrict immigration from? How will we restrict legal immigration in order to get DACA done? And Trump was being like, oh, you guys, you know, he was like, oh, like, why can't we restrict it to Norway? Like, why? But like, you want
because
the shithole
country. Because they're a functioning country. Why would they want to fucking come here?
If you look
at it, here's the job.
This country's a burning Chuck E. Cheese. Why would you go into it? So, your own power.
They're like big bears trying to catch the salmon swimming upstream. The salmon are jobs. And they're swimming back.
But what has been unremarked upon is that this is a massive, that would be a massive giveaway. That would be an astounding, if you had told any political observer a year ago that a Senate Democrat would be negotiating to restrict legal immigration in order to get some version of the Dream Act through, they would be like, what are you talking about? That makes no sense. Because these negotiations were happening sort of quickly and largely under the radar, like no one really noticed how much of the farm Democrats were preparing to give away.
Well, this is the idea. Like
that's a 40-plus year precedent.
Yes.
since the Immigration Act of like 1965, I think.
Yeah.
That would be reversed.
So I just want to read from your piece real quick. You say here, Democratic leadership has completely conceded, rhetorically and politically, that this is now the middle ground. The fact that hardliners would prefer an even more extreme policy is all the justification they need. This is the rationale. And you're quoting from Politico here that writes, key Democrats are sympathetic to the Fuhrer from their left flank, but aware that something needs to pass Congress that can win Trump's signature. Senate negotiators believe their emerging agreement, which they say they're getting close to finalizing, will lose votes from the right and left, representing true concessions from both
yeah,
parties.
Baby. Yeah, both the final center!
Both Tom Cotton and the Congressional Black Caucus will oppose our deal, so it is by definition bipartisan. This is how far-right policy becomes centrist in less than a year. And this is how Democrats are negotiating with a historically unpopular president in a midterm election year on an issue which they held immense amount of leverage just a month ago. So they are...
negotiating.
They are... the position that the Democrats are negotiating from is the position that Stephen Miller wanted to begin
yes,
with.
No, I know. And what's crazy about it is it'd be one thing if you had a united Republican Party that wanted... that would agree with Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller... up until Trump, Stephen Miller's position was an outlier in his own party. The Republicans were not in favor of restricting legal immigration except for the hard right. This is why Bush tried comprehensive immigration reform, only for it to fail because of the hard right. They are negotiating from against Republicans who don't even want to be voting to restrict immigration because they're, you know, rich business Republicans who like cheap labor. It's like astounding that the Overton window shifted that quickly with barely anyone sort of noticing.
And this is how Democrats negotiate too. Democrats, their argument against anything that people actually want, be it socialized medicine or, you know, leaving Afghanistan, is like, oh, that'll never pass. So we're going to our express position that we even run on is the compromise, because that's yes. how negotiations work. If you compromise before you even get to the table, yeah. you get exactly what you came for. Like they fundamentally don't understand negotiation. It's like you come in, roll over on your belly, say please, 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 and then hope that they don't take even more.
Well, and not only that, like, and then they come out of this meeting and go like, the president said the horrible things, and like, you know, like, and of course, like, you know,
I showed up naked like he wanted, and he still said bad things.
I mean, it is grotesque, particularly to as far as, like, you know, Haiti goes, to call Haiti a shithole, especially.
Yeah, by all means, he's a cruel, stupid person, but oh my God, will you stop freaking out every time Trump is Trump?
Well, here's the thing. It's become another round of, like, of what I've noticed is, like, the people, like, the resistance people, this becomes another whole round of, like, demanding that cable news anchors call the president racist, which is like, okay, if you're over 60, fine. Invest yourself in what MSNBC says or doesn't say. For anyone other than that, I don't know why you're wasting your time.
I love that. And then the corollary to that is websites that only liberals read, like, congratulating themselves for calling Trump racist in a headline.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you did. All those Trump voters who read Daily Beast are sure going to make him not be president.
Well, I will say, like, Trump got the Democrats out of this shitty deal they were cutting. Like, again, like, just by saying shitheads, he blew it up. Like, I don't think it was already because I tried to be fair when I was writing that. For once, I tried to be fair. You know, a lot of Senate Democrats,
Alex.
A lot of Senate Democrats were already, like, furious at the deal as it was emerging. It was sort of Dick Durbin seemed to be just sort of going out on his own and hoping that people would fall in line. Like, Kamala Harris was against it, and basically
it was Durbin and Lindsey Graham came to this meeting, and then they showed up to find that what's his name, Tom Cotton and Bob Goodlatte were there.
Yeah,
they weren't expecting to be in the meeting, but Stephen Miller had invited them there just to make sure.
They didn't cut a deal.
Yeah, exactly.
A deal that he would have preferred to the
status
quo.
And then he said, like, they were proposing, Graham and Durbin were proposing cutting the visa lottery program by 50% and prioritizing countries that are already in the system.
How are they allowing him to negotiate about the visa lottery system while he's going around thinking that the visa lottery system is where other countries hold a fake lottery in their... in their homelands and then send people over? He doesn't know how it works.
He'd know. Obviously.
But like, I mean, it's one thing, like, oh, he doesn't know. He has an idea in his head that is an insane fantasy where they're like holding a, there's a national.
There's a bunch of ping pong balls.
Right, exactly. There's a bunch of ping pong balls on Kyrgyzstani television and he's like spinning around, but because they're in charge of it, they're like pulling out only the balls they want. And so all of their jihadists and murderers go.
How stupid
are
we?
Not what the fucking visa lottery is. It's conducted by the State Department. No one has told him this, and he's in the room negotiating the fate of it.
I actually think it's very possible that someone has told him this multiple times.
Yeah, and he just, like, still he's in his mind palace where he's in a casino in Kyrgyzstan. And
yeah.
He's making everyone play the Big Bang Theory slot machine, and he's like, oh, they don't know. I'm only going to let the nines and tens win. The art of the deal.
And thinking about this, like, broader, like, the failure of the Democrats to articulate or even negotiate what should be a popular winning position for them, or just to not cut a deal with the president. I mean, it's insane the thing that they have to put something on his desk.
Well, so they, like, they, first of all, like, what they had the leverage, and they theoretically might still have it to basically threaten a shutdown until a clean version of DACA is passed.
No, like that was,
yeah, I know.
So, you can't, like, do it.
But the other thing, like, the justification. So I got on a Twitter argument this afternoon because I was bored mostly, and because the guy who I was responding to was like an elected official, and I was like, "You are too dumb." He was like, "I guess you don't want any deal because you want to sacrifice dreamers at the altar of purity politics."
You should be like, "Yes,
yeah,
literally."
Yes,
I want to dress them all in white. I'm going to set up an altar.
I'm going to light some incense.
I'm going to wear a goat's skull. Yes, that is what I want.
I thought it was weird how one of Bernie's positions was to bring back Aztec flower wars.
Yeah, no, yeah.
We have not seen Quetzalcoatl in over 3 lunar cycles.
it's an argument about tactics and strategy here. And if you want to get, like, a clean DACA or some version of the Dream Act passed, well, first of all, like, the question of what Trump signs is answered by anything you put on in front of him. Like, you know, Miller has some influence over him, but if the Republicans put it on his desk, he'll sign it. Like, he's shown that time and time again.
Have they tried putting, like, emojis on it, or like, you know, making it more appealing to him.
I mean, someone probably has, but yeah. But like Miller, like it's the White House is.
I like the little smiling.
The White House is like a door slamming stage farce. Yeah. So it's like every time they try to get like one policy in front of him, Stephen Miller is like kneeling behind someone, hoping for someone to push them over.
I mean, like, okay, so. On the one hand, you have the Stephen Miller view of immigration, which is that if it's not from a white country, we're not interested, mm-hmm. right? Or we should try to basically end all immigration to America from any country other than, you know, first world Western white countries, mm-hmm. right? The Democratic view, on the other hand, I feel like they like I said earlier, they can't articulate a competing vision to this because whether it's people in countries that maybe aren't so nice, to use a better word than shithole, or even parts of this country or people in America right now who live in places that are impoverished, immiserated, or maybe not so nice to live, the Democrats still believe in this like meritocratic vision of like you have to earn your way out of these hellholes, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to demonstrate some kind of usefulness.
Regardless of why those places are miserable.
Exactly.
Which may or may not have something to do with the precedent of American foreign policy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, their favorite thing to do is to post like army veterans from Haiti and shit.
Yeah.
Their absolute favorite thing to do because there's no interrogation of like, so we should have this imperial executive branch where Trump orders this guy to die in like whatever African republic and lie about it because he found like a Navy SEAL stealing money just because we're invading all these countries. You're not interrogating the fact that he has to earn his humanity to you by killing and dying for you. It's just like, no, you didn't go to Vietnam, Trump, you pussy.
Yeah.
You were
yeah.
too busy being gay with Vladimir Putin to kill a bunch of farmers.
Well, and I do think that there's like a danger in, you know, reducing entire countries to the sort of, you know, pain and misery and exploitation they've experienced. But also, let's acknowledge that many of these places are miserable for many of their inhabitants, specifically because of us.
Oh, absolutely.
This idea of being like, I've seen a lot of people be like, look at all the beautiful music and food in Haiti. And it's like, okay, but also.
You should be able to say there's a lot of Haiti, like, it's not
so nice.
Beautiful
music and food
in
the American South.
Yeah.
I mean that, but that's perfect because before this even the sort of liberal centrist and even like Rubio cuck argument for immigration was like, don't you like foreign food?
Yeah,
and it's like, well, these are human beings, you fucking.
Well,
this weirdo.
Is the only way they understand universalism or some kind of egalitarianism is through bourgeois cosmopolitanism.
Right. It's
they have amazing beaches.
Yeah, it's Yelp world order.
Going further down this path of both the Democrats, both like having this two-step of being like Trump is the most vulgar, unfit for office, like authoritarian dictator America's ever had, but then still largely acceding to everything he's doing or being willing to play along with it, and this idea of the imperial presidency. I want to talk a little bit about the extension of NSA surveillance that passed this week with...
Big win.
Yeah.
actually, it passed the House.
It passed the House, but it passed with votes from Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic chair of the House Intelligence Committee. And this is an extension of the FISA Act. Just a rundown here. This is from the EFF.org. The House bill today, it endorses all warrantless searches of databases containing Americans' communications, provides a narrow and seemingly useless warrant requirement that applies only for searches in some later stage criminal investigations, allows for the restarting of, quote, about collection, an invasive type of surveillance that the NSA ended last year after being criticized by the FISA court for privacy violations, and sunsets in 6 years, which delays Congress's best opportunity to debate the limits of NSA surveillance. They also voted down an amendment to the bill that was offered by Justin Amash of Michigan, a Republican who's sort of like a libertarian Republican, which would have required law enforcement agents to get a warrant before searching NSA data for information on Americans. Let's see here. This is what Pelosi said. Respectful of the debate on this issue, I myself will be voting to support my ranking members of the Intelligence Committee, referring to the bill's roots in a template from the Intelligence Committee, weighing the equities, that's the path I will take. House Speaker Paul Ryan also spoke in for support of the bill and against an amendment from a member of his own party, speaking of the Amish Amendment. He says, I want to thank Pelosi for coming up and speaking against the Amish Amendment and in favor of the underlying bipartisan bill. So again, there's this massive cognitive dissonance between believing that Trump is a reckless white nationalist racist authoritarian, but still voting to re-up the essentially limitless surveillance powers that we've given, imbued the office of the presidency with.
No, you don't get it. Like, the NSA is going to use it to prove he did Russia stuff.
You know what? I'm not even kidding. I looked into resistance Twitter about this, and a lot of people were saying it's a big win because with the surveillance powers, the NSA is going to take down Trump.
Oh my God!
They're going to take down Trump, and this is going to, like, it's going to blow all the Russia collusion.
The Cossacks work for the Tsar. You should know that phrase, you fucking idiots.
But the thing that's amazing to me is, like, if you're saying that the Russia conspiracy happened to the extent that it did, even if you're not on, like, the Eric Garland end of the spectrum, if you're more of, like, a 6 than a 10, shouldn't the NSA have prevented that? Isn't that exactly why they're there?
Sorry.
I don't know. I think you're all missing the fact that our continued security as a country is dependent on Donald Trump's ability to remotely activate Suzanne Summers' webcam.
Hey, hello, is this Candace Bergen? You've been being very unfair to me. Oh, thank God we gave him this power. Graydon Carter, I see you. You look like shit. Frankly, I'm in your Alexa.
Sorry, this is just a quick bit from the Intercept right up in this. It also said about Devin Nunes circulated a flyer opposing the Amish Amendment with pictures of the Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev.
Yeah, that they also remember when they prevented that. The NSA? That was awesome.
Who can forget when they stopped that from happening?
But
actually, it was just a picture of it that said wood.
It was like, this has nothing to do with the amendment, but, like, he's innocent. I just want to say, all my free Jahar people, Troy, I love you.
Well, this is an annoying one. I mean, it's because Democrats actually there were enough Republicans. The amendment, the Warren Amendment, had Democratic co-sponsors. I think Zoe Lofgren was one of them. So this actually could have passed the House, like, fairly easily, and if it had, like an actual meaningful reform would have then had a chance in the Senate, and they just pissed it away because Pelosi, like, can't be bothered to like actually take a stand on it. And
what is the calculus for Pelosi here? Like, what would be, like, why? Where does she see, like, the negative in like? What's the loss here in not opposing this?
I honestly think that official Washington, they believe their own bullshit on this, and they have intel agencies whispering in their ears that they have to be allowed to do anything they want. That's a big part of it, and the other part of it is this deeply ingrained belief by Democrats that if anything bad ever happens, they'll be blamed for being soft on terrorism.
Oh yeah,
that's that which I think.
I mean, I think it's interesting to contrast this era now with, like, you know, the late 70s, in which the last time there really was an effort by Congress to rein in the imperial presidency. I mean, there was a lot of pushback against it, but there were Democrats and liberal Republicans of that era that did sought to bring reforms to the intelligence are vast. At that time, then it was vast. Now it's even more expansive. But, like, there was an effort to rein it in the late 70s, and now it's been completely abandoned.
You go back and look at the Church Commission and the reforms that happened in the 70s, and it's actually unimaginable to think of that happening today after fairly similar scandals, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, there's the sort of overarching theory that 9/11 broke the country's brain and made everything like immeasurably stupider, and that might be the reason why. You know, like, what I find infuriating about it is that, like, there's not a constituency of voters who are like please retain the Patriot Act and expand surveillance. Like, they live in a hypothetical fear of being punished by voters for terror happening and then being blamed.
I think there's something to that, the 9/11 argument, but there were, you know, mass protests, and there was still an anti-war movement.
Yeah.
It died under Obama.
Oh, yeah, because everyone was like, all right, we did it.
Oh,
like,
it's pack fine.
Pack up and go home.
I think, though, one of the most, like, effective acts of propaganda was America after 9/11. It was the troops thing, because it was fluid. It wasn't just troops were troops anymore. The CIA is troops. I mean, did you see?
I'm a troop.
Yeah, I'm
Felix
a
troop. No, there
was
a
bouncer. I was a troop.
Yeah. Someone did. What was the? I don't remember who did the tweet, but they were like, I was just watching CNN or something, and they were. What did they say? It was like someone or other. Oh yeah, farmers are protecting our crops. And like that was yeah. They were like thank you to farmers for protecting our crops. And like that's precisely what I mean by like 9/11 made America stupider in that sense. Like suddenly
nothing is ever just producing anything. You're always protecting something. Yes.
Yeah. So even if you're supposed to be sort of on the left of that issue, like the other day someone found a tweet from Nicholas Kristof in 2014 where he goes. You know what? People talking about those CIA guys who were crying while they were torturing people. That shows humanity. And it's like they were literally torturing somebody.
But they felt really bad about it.
You know who was also crying? The people they were torturing.
I sort of think about the movie Zero Dark Thirty, and how there are all these little cultural snippets you're supposed to put in there, like that it's a cool badass woman doing it, that one of the first scenes is her like torturing that guy with Jason Isaacs, or that the one counterterrorism guy takes out a prayer rug. And I think that propaganda of, all right, we've got you in the position of you have to say that you love the troops, and also we're going to expand troops to anyone who defends anything, which, like you said, could be farmers, it could be mall security, it could be moderators on a message board, that they're brave. The brave men and women phrase I've heard so much in reference to Trump. In reference to Trump being mean to the CIA or the FBI, the idea that they're sacrificing for us every day, these people who go into a HVAC perfectly 70 degree office every day and eat salads from Cosi and like go into Excel and decide which 14-year-olds they're going to murder, like that they're risking their life somehow.
This started with George W. Bush in 2008. And then it was, of course, expanded throughout the entire Obama administration. And there's a certain logic in that, like, all these people who loved Obama were like, well, it's okay because the good guy now has his hand on the till.
We're going to win the presidency forever.
Vast surveillance state. And yeah, and they expected that it would happen forever. But now that Trump, literally their worst nightmare, the probably the most irresponsible, like, least qualified person ever is in the Oval Office, they're still largely okay with it, and I'll tell you why. Because now they've put their face entirely in the deep state, or like, I mean, I'm using that in quotation marks, but they've put their faith entirely in these gigantic federal law enforcement and intelligence apparatus to as a check on Trump. And
well, also, the Democratic Party does not exist to produce policy. They exist to reproduce the Democratic Party at this point. And they can definitely keep doing that under Trump. I mean, they, you know, one needs the other.
Just one other thing about this. This is the thing, the vote on the bill. Yeah, I'm reading from The Intercept. This said again, it says, the vote followed a morning of confusion as President Donald Trump tweeted in opposition to the bill, referencing a conspiracy theory about then-President Barack Obama spying on the Trump campaign. He walked himself back 2 hours later, tweeting, we need it. Get smart.
Yeah, it was actually, in the morning, it was a fantastic story for our age, because what happened that morning is Andrew Napolitano on Fox News literally turned to the camera and said, don't do FISA, President Trump. And Trump tweeted, let's not do FISA. And then John Kelly and Paul Ryan had him on the phone for an hour. And they told him, they lied to him. And they told him, oh, no, FISA is only for foreigners. It won't ever affect Americans. And then he tweeted, we got to do FISA. But in that hour, Republicans were like, are we against it now? Like, well, we don't know.
That's why they ultimately gave him the power, because he showed he had a nuanced position.
Exactly,
on the issue,
yeah. Exactly.
And he could listen to people. I've done a lot of learning this morning. It turns out I can use this to have conversations with Anna Wintour.
So that led to a great resistance response, too, where like the Lawfare blog guys and Senator Mark Warner were like, they looked at Trump's tweets and they were like, what a hugely dangerous misunderstanding of the issue this is. Like, oh my God. And this is why we must renew his authority to oversee these programs. Like, that was their argument. Like,
you learn by doing. They think that the presidency is like a Montessori school.
Yeah. Mr. President, in light of recent concerns about this bill, we are giving you a sippy cup while you sign it.
We're giving you Diet Coke all over it. We're giving you a sippy cup and a gun.
Yeah. I think that, don't mix them up. I think like that is the thing you have to keep in mind, is that ultimately this is a cruel, stupid man. And like they seem to both understand that he's stupid, yet panic at some at the idea that he's like kind of pure evil incarnate. Like he's like movie evil is what they think, where like he just exists to do bad things. And that to the point where it's not even about self-preservation or he lacks any motivation besides hurting other people, because he is cruel. But also like clearly it's easy to influence this person because he is deeply stupid.
He's like the
Joker.
If
you would just do anything at all, ever.
The last guy who's going to have words with him is always going to be Kelly or one of those gatekeeping monsters. So I don't think you're ever going to.
Maybe
really
he would like Pelosi if she ever showed some balls. She looks like that puppet, madam.
Well,
so that might be entertaining for him.
It actually is true that when you looked at the White House, they did the immigration negotiation on camera to prove that that Trump's brain works still. And what happened on camera was Dianne Feinstein was like, all right, so clean DACA. And Trump was like, yeah, let's do clean DACA. And Kevin McCarthy, the House GOP whip, like leaned over and was like, that's not our position, Mr. President. Well, but it is. It's like the president, like the policy is being set by John Kelly and these guys.
Well, you can't blame him for that, because like when a powerhouse of charisma like Dianne Feinstein tells you.
I sat in a room with her once, ended up naked, don't even remember how.
Yeah, she could talk me into doing anything.
I do want to talk about the hilarious scandal that in any other timeline would have been like the leading
thing. It's so insane.
Now, before we get there, I'm just going to have to, you know, little vegetables before we get to our dessert here. I do want to bring up one last thing that is, you know, I think more monstrous now than like any than Trump calling other countries shitholes, like, or certainly more consequential. I'm talking about this new thing where they're now allowing states to require Medicaid beneficiaries to work or lose access to healthcare.
Yeah.
And I just want to read Kentucky has already gone through with this, and I want to read a couple things from the new program. There is actually literally a literacy provision that says here, this is from the
Bold,
Kentucky
innovative
bill.
Moves in American
state-approved health literacy or financial literacy course. Beneficiaries who are in an eligibility suspension for failure to meet the requirement on their redetermination date will have their enrollment terminated and will be required to submit a new application. Kentucky will provide good cause exemptions in certain circumstances for beneficiaries who cannot meet requirements.
So you don't get your chemo until you bring back a book report on Treasure Island.
This is a sorry,
it's the Simpsons. It's the stupid babies need the most attention, but they do actually.
There, I'm reading. This is Andy Slavitt. I'm reading from sort of like compiled the rundown of this horror show. There's a 6-month lockout provision, which means that you can't apply again for 6 months if you were removed from not registering annually, or if you have a kid or get married and don't report it. And it says that this is for, quote, certain populations. The language is, it says, disenrollment and 6-month non-eligibility period for certain populations for failure to report a change in circumstance that would affect Medicaid eligibility.
Yeah, I mean, it's either death by 1,000 cuts or it's just making the process so arduous. And anyone who's ever had to do this knows how miserable it is. Anyone who's ever had to go through any of these systems. Actually, it was great in Indiana. I have to say, getting food stamps in Indiana was great. You just showed up, they filled out the shit for you. Getting it here, it is impossible now. They've cut like the number of people they have at the offices. If you ever, for example, like have to get unemployment in the month of December, you will literally blow your brains out waiting on hold.
I mean, Amber, you bring it up, but it says in the bill here, it says, in addition, where an individual experiences a period of non-eligibility, Kentucky is providing opportunities to return eligibility. Several commentators noted that the state's Medicaid offices, where many beneficiaries go to report those changes, and the phone lines used to call to report changes are already busy, and the calls and visits are time-consuming.
Yep.
So it's like overtaxing an already overtaxed, like nightmarish call.
Well, and I think it's all intentional. This sounds paranoid, but I think building up bureaucrat, like literally spending more money on more bureaucracy to keep people out as a means to shut it down,
it's like the drug testing regimes for welfare recipients that cost vastly
so
more than they stop fraud with. But you know what? This is the price we pay because, as we all know, and as Louis Brandeis said, the states are the meth labs of democracy. We have to let them just cook up whatever freakish monster babies that they're putting together in their Erlenmeyer flasks.
It's totally intentional. It's the welfare reform model. You make it more of a pain in the ass to sign up. You make it easier to throw someone off. And then when the number of people enrolled goes down, you point at that number and say, it's a success.
Yeah, we're fixing the problem.
We fixed it.
Anybody who wants to talk to you about how healthcare reform, well, whatever form it takes, needs to be dynamic and to allow for experimentation states to find out the best way to deliver quality care. Fuck you. There needs to be one universal standard for everybody. It is genuinely psychotic that someone can die
low barrier
in one
to entry,
state and
you
live
will
in another.
Spend less money just based making a low barrier to entry.
Based on
the savagery of their state government.
Before the housing crisis, like I said, before the housing crisis in Indiana, you just were like, I don't have any money. I got fired. And they're like, here's $200 a month for food. And that was it. And you saw it slowly change. It started with you getting cards that said, not Bank of America, but a major bank on the back. And that was your new SNAP card. Like it started with them facilitating it. And then it got harder and harder, and it became there were fewer and fewer people working at the office. There were longer and longer hold times. And then, you know, you move to New York, they basically bombed out the entire fucking office. It's impossible to get that shit.
Yeah, and even if you do have health insurance, like I know somebody who recently had a health scare, and she had to go in to get a spinal tap, and she had to go through like 7 phone banks to figure out if her insurance covered it and how much insurance she would need to get and which doctor to go to, and the phone lines are busy. That's even if you get in. And yeah, part of this is by design. It's, as everyone said, making things more complicated, so you have to go through 3 rat mazes to get one piece of cheese.
They want to exhaust and punish poor people for trying to get food, health care, unemployment, housing aid, anything.
Right, and that's the, on the right-wing side of it, it just literally is eugenics. So on the
Democratic side, it's this meritocracy that they love believing in.
Right.
It's this idea.
Well,
back
and
to this
also,
idea
they're
of,
little fucking nerds, and they're like, oh, well, here's a new system. We're going to improve it by adding more shit on it.
Yeah, like once we have everyone, you know, everyone will enjoy filling out their forms and making choices.
What if it's like a fun puzzle to get your food?
Yeah, but it's like they don't realize that, like, For people who had to get assistance before, or for anyone who just doesn't have a top flight plan where they can just kind of go wherever is a network and it's fine, they're already doing that. They're already scrolling through menus. Maybe they don't look as pretty as the Obamacare website, but it can't. The only two choices can't be means testing and means testing with eugenics behind it, because it makes no difference to the average person who has to access them. It has to be different. It doesn't matter if one is just out of sheer cruelty and one is because, I don't know, a bunch of roller backpack kids thought it was cool.
To Matt's point about the savageries of these local governments experimenting, just a comment from the governor of Kentucky, Bevin.
Absolute piece of shit. He ran on election on the promise of taking away the Medicaid expansion in Kentucky altogether, which he wasn't able to do once he took power. And so this is sort of the next best thing.
This is what he said about these new work requirements. He said, low-income people in Kentucky will now learn dignity and self-respect.
I also think we can't underestimate the fact that a lot of these people really do have, like, anti-humanistic contempt.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Matt Bevin.
Yeah.
Probably.
Again, I think, doesn't matter. doesn't matter. I mean, it's like looking at the...
Well, yeah, their intentions don't really
matter. Yeah, someone was telling me they went on some... they went on like a safari trip and they saw a lion eat the liver out of a buffalo. And I was like, how do you know it's the liver? And like, they always eat the liver first. And that raised this really weird question to me where I was like, holy shit. And I look it up and it's true. And is it more nutritious? It is more nutritious. And so I'm like, okay, that lion, does it eat it because it knows that it's more nutritious on some level, or does it taste better? Is this like delight? Is this cuisine? Or is it home economics? And the answer doesn't fucking matter because he ate the fucking liver regardless.
Well, it doesn't matter the water buffalo.
Yes,
that's for sure.
Exactly. So don't waste too much time, I really think, trying to figure out what balance of malice / ignorance these people have. The point is, it's dangerous.
So moving on from a serious topic to just based instinct and desire. Can we talk
how does this happen? How do you
spend the whole
week on shithole? The last second.
Can we talk about Stormy Daniels, y'all?
Wait a minute. Is this some meteorologist? I'm not familiar with this person.
I've never heard
of this person.
All of us have been sitting in my apartment going through the Stormy Daniels catalog, like Bob Crane and John Carpenter in autofocus, just bros doing research together, preparing
regular
for the
guys.
Show. Regular guys being friends, watching movies together.
I mean, look, I can think that Donald Trump is a reprehensible person and also think that it's cool that he's Eskimo Brothers with Johnny Sins at the same time. I can think that that's an important moment for me, too.
See, here's the thing. Is my big shock when this thing came out was, okay, wait a minute. Are you telling me that he paid this woman to keep quiet about the fact that they had sex?
Yeah.
Because I'm very much on team incel Trump or non-cel Trump.
Asexual Trump.
As an asexual being.
Yeah.
Like, what... I honestly think, okay, a month from the election, he's in the middle of the pussy grabber thing. His base isn't deserting him. How many people really would have had their minds changed by hearing he banged a porn star? That's actually kind of cool for
also,
a lot of dipshits in America.
Also, he used to tell Ivana to like speak very explicitly about their sex life.
Right, yeah, he loved that stuff.
Just like do these tall tales.
Exactly.
You know,
I think what he was really paying her for was what
they did instead of sex. Look these up, though, because it is almost childish.
Yeah, because
like the things he had her say were like, yeah, his dick was big as a table. Like
exactly.
Like someone who's never had sex.
And so if that comes out, it's no big deal. But if Stormy Daniels comes out and says, okay, he took me into this hotel suite. He had me roll him around in flour and then knead his excess torso flesh out like pizza dough. Even the MAGA people would be like, dude, that's fucked up.
I did
all the things you do during sex and more, frankly. I started out the sexual procedure, which was truly excellent, with a penultimate act of, you know, first you have to find the pussy. That's a lot of people have trouble finding the pussy. I can find it. It's right on the front of the pelvis, similar to a penis. Where else would it be? And then, you know, I go, hey, can we put my thing in your thing? Okay, great. I do my thing, you know, I'm go rocking back and forth like you do during sex, and boom, I'm peeing. It's great.
He 100% paid her to get, you know, balls of gauze and clean the smegma out of his gunt.
Oh, yeah, so we did real sex. We certainly didn't wear matching Planet Hollywood kimonos and watch TMZ. That didn't happen.
I don't have bed sores.
I did, you know, and the best part of sex is right after, when you pat her on the back and say, excellent work. Superb, luxurious.
What I like about this is in any other reality, this would have been
the
story of the century. I guarantee you everyone will have forgotten this by the time this episode
comes
out.
Imagine if Obama fucked Kendra Lust. And he's like, I was at the AVN for some reason.
Shithole will be done in 2 weeks. This will definitely be done by the time this airs.
But as long as we're talking about this, we have Alex here. Alex, you're a media critic, a journalist. You're someone in this. The interesting thread to this story is that Jacob Weisberg of Slate.com, yes. That Sylvester the Cat sounding motherfucker.
Oh my God.
Had this story. He had Stormy Daniels on the record in October 2016 saying Trump's fucking psycho lawyer, Michael Cohen, another absolute winner, that guy paid her this $130,000 hush money to, you know, cover this up or whatever. He had this on record in October 2016. Then she stops returning his phone calls, obviously, assuming because she was paid off by, or, you know, or they shut her up in some way.
Yeah.
And she just released some fucking letter that sounds like, you know, fucking, she might as well be holding up today's copy of the New York Times. But, so then Weisberg says, I had this on record, but I didn't publish it because I didn't have her consent to do it.
Which, okay.
And so, this was like a week after the pussy grabbing thing. Yeah. I mean, like, we can debate whether or not anyone would have given a shit about this, but it does, it would have been a huge story in the election.
And
a huge story coming on the heels of the pussy grabbing tape. And it's like, well, Weisberg is now saying this to the New York Times, presumably without Ms. Daniels' consent.
Yeah, so, still doesn't.
Why the fuck didn't he release it when he had a chance that it would have made a fucking difference, if at all?
It's an incredible fuck up. And my colleague Tom Skoka was just saying this. First of all, if you had her on the record saying this to you, then you had her consent to publish, because that's what on the record means.
Yeah.
So second of all, she's not a victim of any sort of attack. She was, by all accounts, it was a consensual sexual act.
A handshake.
Yeah, exactly. The idea of needing her consent to publish what she voluntarily told you on the record, we're not talking about an assault or a rape or anything else here. We're talking about fucking, like, porn star having sex with a celebrity.
Two hot people banging.
Yeah, exactly.
Two
beautiful people in the prime of their lives doing a totally natural
act. Comes natural, yeah.
Not at all like a naked mole rat rolling around.
I think it probably just wasn't that good or conformable or anything. Like, he just thought it was a bullshit nothing story because Trump has never fucked.
We did fuck, and they destroyed the tape. I paid to destroy the tape because if people saw how good I was, there'd be no more porn industry.
But they said
would be too insecure to ever reproduce.
People have called me the White Lexington Steel. It's not a name I came up with, but it's really great, really interesting stuff.
People are saying it more and more.
People are saying, and look, this boy Timmy Thick is incredible, but I'm even thicker than him. And I didn't even set out to try to do that. I just have very good genes. My dad was a thick man.
He is thicker than Timmy, but he's the wrong side of things.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Another interesting.
Timmy's got some time.
Another interesting sort of connection to the Stormy Daniels affair is we talked about it a few episodes ago, the QAnon conspiracy that has consumed so much of the right wing or just online right, and now even people who are offline. The big catchphrase of the QAnon conspiracy is a storm is coming. And by that, they mean that, like, all the celebs and the sickos in the Democratic Party are going to be arrested, or like something, a story, something's coming. And then now these Stormy Daniels revelations, which seem very interesting to me that it all lines up. But however, as a Twitter friend Honored Spirit pointed out, all these same people will be like, no, not this. This is just a coincidence.
This is the deep state. Deep state's doing this.
He's being the opposite of a pedophile.
Yeah.
He's like, it's proof that he does the opposite of pedophilia by sleeping with an adult woman.
An adult film star.
Yeah. And being
she stars in adult films, like Ingmar Bergman films.
Yeah, adult
and,
films. Yeah.
And donating 100.
That actually would be like, yeah. Oh, she was in Phantom Thread, right?
Well, you were saying it would have been bad for him if it came out during the election, but also Hillary fucked Peter North. So that would have come out too. I would have been like, man, there really isn't a choice for a candidate that hasn't been fucked by a porn star. Gary Johnson, no. Him and Riley Reid have done it.
Yeah, I was
deep dicked by the deep state. Yeah.
Well, again, I mean, it's fun to talk about, but it'll all be forgotten.
Everything that you thought was a thing isn't a thing anymore.
Don't lose all your fucking marbles over everything that happens.
It's just
I know
funny.
We're all experiencing a lot of overstimulation at the moment.
Yes.
Maybe soothe yourself with some gaming.
We're all the guys in the centrifugal simulator at NASA with your face all spread.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Like I'm just saying.
You know, try and take care of yourself.
Pushing it.
Know that you have like a capacity for this stuff, and you don't want your brain to pop.
Yeah,
it's funny.
But also have a little laugh.
It's funny. It's fun. Watch some Stormy Daniels videos with your boys.
Yeah.
If you're of a weak mind, you can't follow all this stuff. You can't follow every micro controversy. You can't follow every awful thing he says. You can't follow every little culture war thing. You can't follow everyone he's pretended to have sex with. That's for people with strong brains. That's us. We're doing it.
Yeah.
And we can do
that's
it.
That's our job. We're troops.
Yeah, we're troops in that.
It's our job to think about the president sweatily rubbing up against Stormy Daniels.
Which is why all of us voted for him. Because we knew about this.
You know what,
cool.
Alex? It doesn't feel like a job.
No.
The
day it feels like a job is the day I get out of here.
like our cousins in the army say. Best job I ever had.
I like to think of my job as keeping the post safe. Like, someone's got to keep the post
that
safe.
People were wondering what the fuck Jacob Weisberg was thinking by sitting on that.
Suffering fuck attacks.
I'll tell
thinking.
You what it was. He wanted to make sure that they could keep doing the Trump cast.
Yeah.
That's the most popular thing that he does is their stupid fucking Trump cast.
It actually proves Trump right when he claimed that the media would fall in line in 2020 because they need him.
They do. They need that content. Any other president, this would be the biggest thing to happen during their presidency. It would probably result in resignation.
Yeah.
And now it is something that will be gone by the end of the month.
Yeah.
Which is
cool.
You know what? It's like,
it is cool,
with this
but
stuff,
it's also sort
with
of
this stuff, I am an accelerationist. Yeah. Like,
well,
just
we are accelerating, baby.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Do you think that if you were falling in space, that you would slow down after a while or go faster and faster? Faster and faster. And for a long time you wouldn't feel anything. And then you'd burst into fire. And the angels wouldn't help you.
So to close things out for this week, we got Alex Perrine on the scene. I want to do a reading series now. As a tip of the cap to the dearly departed Tarfu report, I want to read now with Alex David Brooks's column from this week, which is very germane to everything we've just talked about, because David wrote this on Tuesday, always proving that, you know, he's just way ahead of the curve on, you know, these, they always look good in retrospect, especially this week. So this is David Brooks writing his op-ed in the New York Times this week. The headline of the piece is "The Decline of Anti-Trumpism." David writes, "Let me start with three inconvenient observations based on dozens of conversations around Washington over the past year." Wait, on Tarfo, did you guys inhale helium or nitrous?
We would inhale helium, and then we ran out of helium, and we realized too that we could actually kill ourselves inhaling that much helium. So then we switched to a drinking game.
Okay,
if he bemoans the younger generation, the kids today. If he does thinly veiled autobiography, if he brings up humility, virtue, and character.
Mm-hmm.
And
name drops other writers.
Name dropping is a big one. Yeah. So if he name drops other writers, and then it's two drinks if it's a figure from antiquity.
And then if he references the decline of democracy, you got to give your homeboy a massage.
Matt, there's some maker's mark left there.
Yes.
Would you like to be our guinea pig?
Right above Will's Xi Jinping book. That he
the
has.
The Governance of China. It's an important book.
Yeah.
Okay. So Brooks goes, "Let me start with three inconvenient observations based on dozens of conversations around Washington over the past year. First, people who go into the White House to have a meeting with President Trump usually leave pleasantly surprised. Well, that's because their expectations were so astronomical, so fucking low to begin with. But he goes, they find that Trump is not the raving madman they expected from his tweet storms or the media coverage. They generally say that he is affable, if repetitive. He runs a normal...
Especially when he's sundowning.
He runs a normal, good meeting and seems well-informed enough to get by. Normal White House meetings.
well enough informed to get by. Great standard for the President of the United States.
I could walk up to him and I say, how are you doing? And he says, I'm having a regular one, and that's good enough for me.
Second, people who work in the Trump administration have wildly divergent views about their boss. Some think he is a deranged child, as Michael Wolff reported.
Some.
But some think he is merely a distraction they can work around.
He's the president! A distraction!
Yes, he could kill everybody on Earth if he presses the wrong button, but you can, you know... It's like when your kid makes a mess. It's
yeah,
okay.
And the thing is, you just if he gets all riled, you got to jingle your car keys in front of him, and then he'll forget that he has the power of life and death over every being on Earth.
I mean, you say that, but again, what has been proven time and time again is that it is very easy to put him on the complete opposite track of what he was 20 minutes ago.
Some make
car keys work.
Some think he is strange, but not impossible. Some genuinely admire Trump. Many filter out his crazy stuff and pretend it doesn't exist.
It seems like a really safe dynamic. Yeah.
This is literally just Jared describing.
Yeah, some people are living in a fantasia. Yeah.
Some people think he's the best father-in-law anyone could have.
My impression is that the Trump administration is an unhappy place to work because there is a lot of
you can't date your interns
because there is a lot of infighting and often and no direction from the top. Mm-hmm. But this is not an administration full of people itching to invoke the 25th Amendment. Yeah, because they'd all be out of work.
Right. Yeah.
Third. The White House is getting more professional.
This is Tuesday. You wrote this last Tuesday.
I love that this is entirely an office management problem from his perspective.
No, that's exactly what he's treating it as.
They now have a chore board that clearly states who's doing the dishes, who's taking out the trash.
They started using Slack, and they have their channels organized really well.
We got a Keurig machine. That way, someone doesn't leave out coffee for it to get stale.
A young man named Virgil Texas told them about the Food Choices channel on Slack, where you can post all meal decisions for affirmation or denial.
I'm imagining David Brooks writing this about our office, where it's like there are far less outbursts. It takes them now under 3 hours to decide about lunch. They no longer get distracted watching old Ron Fournier videos on C-SPAN.
The amount of garbage accumulated around Felix Biederman has declined dramatically.
That will never happen.
So the White House is getting more professional. Imagine if Trump didn't tweet.
Imagine if Trump wasn't racist, 70 years old.
The craziness of the past weeks would be out of the way.
I like the fact that the whole thing is like, it's just Twitter. Without Twitter, he'd be a completely normal guy.
If you imagine the president away, the White House suddenly seems much more stable.
Nice building. It has a very good foundation. The studs have been recently replaced.
I know you guys think that this Trump thing is outrageous, but just a little thought experiment. Imagine he's about 30 years younger. He went to Harvard Law. He's black. His name is Barack Obama.
Now do you hate him? Yeah. Checkmate.
Just what I thought.
He says, if he wasn't tweeting, we'd see a White House that is briskly pursuing its goals. The shift in our Pakistan policy, the shift in our offshore drilling policy.
Oh, a shift. That's a lovely way of putting it.
Yeah, the next 4 or 5 Deepwater Horizon incidents was briskly changing the makeup of the Gulf of Mexico. Oh, I like this. The fruition of our ISIS policy. The nomination for judgeships and the formation of policies on infrastructure, DACA, North Korea, and trade.
So he thinks the worst case scenario is that Trump gets in there and he's just like, he gets lost in the bathroom and they don't do anything.
Yeah.
Just, well, just, I mean, the idea of doing anything
well,
is
here's
great.
Well, here's the thing. Like, Brooks sort of has a point here because, like, yes, Trump is an idiotic sideshow who's, like, you know, paying porn stars hush up money or whatever.
But the White
but
House, is, doing
the White House is actually pursuing a policy agenda. It's just that policy agenda is a fucking nightmare, well, he also, as he just laid out. Like, the people they're nominating for the federal courts who are going to be with us until I'm dead, probably, are, like, you know, Count Chocula, Fred Flintstone, the John Birch Jr. Society.
But he has,
PewDiePie is going on the Ninth Circuit Court.
He's wrong even by his own standards, though, because this isn't he's describing this as professionalism, as if this was a sort of normal Republican policy shop. Normal Republican policy is happening, but there's no coherent agenda because it's a bunch of individual actors jockeying to accomplish whatever their goal is. Like, the judges, like, they're getting a ton of them through, but they, like, even people like Chuck Grassley are like, all right, this guy's a little too unqualified for me. Like, you know.
Yeah, but in his mind,
Lionel
the one
Hutz
guy,
is really, like, yeah.
He's the one guy who's just... who thinks that, like, taking away his Twitter would make everything... He thinks that they should be taking away his Twitter the way that people hid FDR's polio.
Yeah.
For the good of the administration.
Well, this is informative, though, because I think that David Brooks speaks for not that big of a slice of the country, but a definite population where, yeah, it's not really the policy. It's that they have to pay attention to his Twitter.
Imagine the Johnson administration without his comically large penis. So he goes, it's almost as if there are two White Houses. There's the Potemkin White House, which we tend to focus on, Trump berserk in front of the TV, the lawyers working the Russian investigation and the press operation. Then there is the invisible White House that you never hear about, which is getting more effective at managing around the distracted boss.
Almost like an unaccountable, invisible state within a state.
I sometimes wonder if the invisible White House has learned to use the Potemkin White House to deke us while it changes the country. Okay, what Brooks is describing here is that if you cover your eyes, Trump thinks you've gone away. Continuing, he says, I mention these inconvenient observations because the anti-Trump movement, of which I'm a proud member, seems to be getting dumber. It seems to be settling into a smug, fairy tale version of reality that filters out discordant information.
A fairy tale version where we believe that if we just struck down the evil Twitter machine...
more anti-Trumpers seems to be telling themselves a Madness of King George narrative. I think that's a sip. Matt, do you think?
Oh, yeah, Madison. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
Madness of King George. Yeah. Okay.
Fictional character King George. Drink up.
Trump.
Be careful, though. We got a party later.
The Madness of King George narrative that Trump is a semi-literate madman surrounded by sycophants who are morally, intellectually. Trump is a semi-literate madman surrounded by sycophants who are morally, intellectually, and psychologically inferior to people like us. That's what Brooks says is the fairy tale narrative.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I think it is kind of a fairy tale because I see nothing in David Brooks that's better than, like, Corey Lewandowski or whatever.
No.
They're just as shitty. So
they all live in the same neighborhood in Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Yeah.
He goes, I'd like to think it's possible to be fervently anti-Trump while also not reducing everything to a fairy tale. The anti-Trump movement suffers from insularity. Most of the people who detest Trump...
I mean, I agree with him on that. They are a bunch of shut-in nerds. But you are the king shut-in nerd.
Yeah, this is Milhouse getting mad at Martin Prince.
I look like a nerd.
Yeah, Milhouse writing a column against Martin Prince. This is what we're listening to.
Most of the people who detest Trump don't know anybody who works with him or supports him. I mean, now this is this idiotic idea that you have to fucking be friends with these...
This is
absolute shithead rube Trump supporters to understand generally that Trump is an awful president doing terrible things.
It's just factually false, and it shows his insularity. It shows Brooks's insularity because, like, do you know who fucking detests Trump? Like, you know, my aunt who lives in the Midwest and knows a shit ton of Trump voters.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
She detests him. Like,
I would, if I knew, if I was actually, like, in social circles with more Trump supporters, I would probably
hate him more.
I would probably joke less about Trump.
I would hate him so much more.
Now I'm very glib and ironic, and I'm like, isn't it funny we have a dumb, crazy president who fucks porn stars?
Yeah.
If I was like living in a community where like I had to deal with these people on a day-to-day basis, people who were like,
Trump's a bitch!
He's my president! Stormy Daniels denied it! This is fake news! Honestly, I would be like buying a mail order.
You know what you'd be? You'd be that woman in Texas who fucking had that boss woman in Texas with the pickup truck that said fuck Trump on the back until they put her in jail.
And then
she came back out and then she added to it fuck Trump and fuck the sheriff.
Fuck the sheriff, yeah.
Well, I've been dating Hope Hicks and it has changed my perspective.
This is actually a common, I want to unpack this a little bit because this is like when conservatives make fun of the old Pauline Kael line. I don't know anybody who voted for Nixon.
Yeah. Sure.
Pauline Kael, she wasn't being ignorant. It wasn't a how did Nixon win. She was stating a fact. In her bubble, she didn't know any Nixon voters. The conservatives who took that as like, oh, they all live in a bubble, are like Manhattan conservatives who, you know, used to write for the National Review or whatever, and who professionally interact with a lot of liberals.
John Podhoretz is a bubble.
Yeah. But do you know who actually lives in insular bubbles are people in white enclaves all across the country who universally voted for Trump. Like, they're the ones who don't know, like, they intentionally live in enclaves of like-minded people, and then people like Brooks are like, you dumb liberals don't know anyone who thinks different than you. And half of us fucking come from families of people who voted for Trump.
Well, yeah, but those Trump people in the enclaves might not know any Hillary voters, but they know Jimmy Kimmel. And Seth Meyers.
They're more like the even larger like number of people, like the people in my extended family who just don't vote.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
So he says the movement also suffers from lowbrowism. Fox News pioneered modern lowbrowism. The modern lowbrow, think Sean Hannity or Dinesh D'Souza, ignores normal journalistic or intellectual
standards. Sean Hannity literally has a lowbrow.
That's true. It's a very low hairline. He creates a style of communication that doesn't make you think more. It makes you think and notice less. The ultimate test of lowbrow is not whether it challenges you, teaches you, or captures the contours of reality. It's whether you feel an urge to share it on social media.
Wow.
I'd say we're very lowbrow. In every war, nations come to resemble their enemies. So I suppose it's normal.
Is that Hobson, dude?
So I suppose it's normal that the anti-Trump movement would come to resemble the pro-Trump movement, but it's not good.
Oh my God!
I've noticed.
Wait, no, but what was that generalized statement? What is he talking about?
Both sides do it. He's blowing my mind.
The next sentence is great.
If you kill the bourgeoisie, do you not then also become the bourgeoisie?
What if you threw out your old phone and it was your new phone that you got?
So he says, it's not good. I've noticed a lot of young people look at the monotonous daily hysteria of we anti-Trumpers and they find it silly.
That's a drink. Because not only is that when he says I've noticed something young people do, what it says is, I've noticed my wife.
This isn't just a struggle over a president. It's a struggle over what rules we're going to play by after Trump. Are we all going to descend permanently into the Trump standard of acceptable behavior?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. We're all going to be fucking porn stars, yo. Or are we going to restore the distinction between excellence and mediocrity, truth and lie? Are we going to insist on the difference between a genuine expert and an ill-informed blowhard? Are we going to restore the distinction between those institutions like the Congressional Budget Office that operate by professional standards and speak with legitimate authority and propaganda mills that don't?
So hard to salvage their credibility after this election. And it's like, no, we're never going to trust your expertise again.
What I like about using the CBO as like a contrast to Fox News is that a big, big project of like really respectable conservatives, specifically Avik Roy and a lot of the Heritage Foundation guys, is to completely change how the CBO does their
forecasts,
that they can do more things like be like show that their insane tax bill will like increase growth and revenue. I don't know who the fuck he's talking about. Here we go. Closing out, final sentences. there's a hierarchy of excellence in every sphere. There's a huge difference between William F. Buckley and Sean Hannity.
No.
No, there Wrong. Fucking isn't.
Sean Wrong. Hannity's alive.
Only, yeah. Only one of them threatened to beat someone up on national television.
And Sean Hannity actually could, because we know he studies MMA and Krav Maga.
Well, he actually has his street style.
I mean, the difference between William F. Buckley and Sean Hannity is Sean Hannity's a more successful television host.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I think he...
So,
yeah, Sean Hannity would never ride a bitch-ass sailboat either. He's all powerboats all the way.
He's, Sean Hannity's a jet ski guy all the way.
And he wouldn't try anything weird with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, he, instead of the skinny dipping in the Long Island channel, it's nude touch ball.
New touch football?
New touch
shirts
football.
And skins yes. every day. Sean yes. Kennedy's house.
We're playing shirts and skins foosball. Sean, what the fuck?
But okay. Nothing below the waist. Yeah. Just shirts and skins.
Just guys being dudes. Okay.
Closing out, part of the struggle is to maintain those distinctions, not contribute to their evisceration.
Wow. There's nothing,
so
there's no
so well done, David Brooks.
That had no content.
No.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There was nothing there.
No.
He says... Oh, you think that the president, that Trump is just his stupid tweets, but he also has a government. Well, yeah, because government has like a continuity, it's bureaucracy, it operates of its own. Okay, what is that? What is that? And Sean Hannity is an oaf, and you need to be less like him. Well, what? He doesn't even have an example of what he's talking about.
Yeah, that's actually one of the killer things about that. That makes it like a killer Brooks column. Is he doesn't even name an example of the thing he's talking about.
Well, is it the example that he's always talking about as himself?
He makes these generalizations. Yeah. It's like the, you know, they always become their enemies. And it's like, when? And then he just keeps going.
I'm guessing that his wife was watching The Daily Show and she laughed at a joke that he thought was like too simplistic. And then he silently judged her and just like gritted his teeth and plowed out a column.
Yeah.
Well, then he's right, because The Daily Show sucks, and I stand with David.
We stand with David.
Yeah.
Well, no, yes. The
David's
Daily
wife stopped watching The Daily Show.
You know what could have
David Brooks'
ever
wife
rating last year?
Go on Chapo.
Last year?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's really depressing.
Wait,
it had its highest ever rating.
That's really depressing.
Ooh, last year.
See, this is why I'm not an accelerationist in terms of entertainment. This is not...
This is not
made comedians funnier.
This is not.
I have a theory. I have a theory.
Mm-hmm. Bots. Say Russian you, bots.
Well, what would you...
Trevor Noah is a Russian bot.
No, but he's close to a machine, and I will tell you why. If you had a relative that was either sundowning or dying, what's something you could put on that wouldn't excite them that much?
Yeah, that Daily Show. It is like... It is. I mean, all of those political comedy shows are dreadful, but there's something just... oatmeal ass about The Daily Show now, where it's just it's been run through a Cuisinart 5,000 times into just total paste. It's like the Soylent of entertainment.
Today, Donald Trump tried to sign a bill, and they had to remind him how to read.
Wait a minute, he's Australian?
Yeah, that's how he sounds like.
Okay.
That's how he sounds like.
It's a difficult accent.
All right, guys. Let's wrap this one up.
Today, Donald Trump tried to wrap something up, and he said, why don't we wrap up the alternative facts and fake news and make Mexico pay for it? Let's bring back Obama. Okay. This is The Daily Show.
Hey, mate, it's The Daily Show here. We're going to talk about Trump, that cunt.
We're talking about peace, mate.
This is Matt V. Brady reporting from South Africa.
Actually, if they put
this
Matt
is Adam
Brady
Friedland's dad on The Daily Show. Adam.
The Daily Show, I would watch. I would definitely watch if it was Adam's dad.
Okay, yeah, guys.
Adam's dad and Matt Brady.
Although Adam's dad is very resistant.
Okay, guys. Till next time, faster and faster.
Faster.
Until we all burn up.
Faster, pussycat. Kill, kill.
Till next week, guys. Bye. Alex, thanks for joining
us. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Chris, for the accelerationist bit, Chris, could you edit in the clip from Twin Peaks Firewalk with me where they go, if you were falling in outer space, would you float forever or would you go faster and faster? And then Laura Palmer says, faster and faster until you burned up and none of the angels could know your name.
Can you put in the thing from Halo 5 where Master Chief disobeys direct orders and goes to go after the Cortana AI? Because that's what we're doing.
Can you put the entirety of Who Let the Dogs Out?